We're back, January 27th, 2015, part two.
The distraction of the strike at KP, if they did have one virtue, and that was to get me freed from the necessity, if in fact it ever had been a necessity, that my commentaries on the station be limited to one or another aspect of the farm labor issue. When the strike was over, I felt under no requirement to return to being the station's one man voice of agricultural labor. And so I embarked upon something totally unrelated. This was in June of 64, in which there was going to be a concerted movement of liberals from the north to liberate the south, as they saw it, and take an active part in the civil rights movement down there. So I commented on that subject, and I did so in a way which I then tried to carry on to the very end of my tenure at KPFA. And that was, whenever possible, to look at a social problem from a slightly different angle than the others in their commentary series. I had a problem with the station because it was quite predictable. They were politically correct before the term political correctness had been coined to apply to what I might have been properly called knee-jerk liberals, who took a certain point of view on every issue that came along and followed it without deviation. So I looked at this invasion, or whatever you might call it, this group of well-meaning liberals from the north moving down south to help with the movement of blacks to eat at lunch counters or to vote or whatever. And I took as my point of departure the children's crusade of the Middle Ages, when they, with every good intention, tried to liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims without any preparation. They were clad in the raiment of righteousness and thought that that would prevail over everything. Well, I thought that the well-meaning liberals from the north, all of whom were white, incidentally, should have prepared themselves by learning a little about the culture of the south into which they were moving. They seemed to take the view that the blacks in the south were just like themselves, except for the color of their skin, when in fact the blacks in the South were carriers of a culture very different from that of the North in many respects, of which race relations were only one part. And so they went down there ill-prepared and just as the children's crusade of the Middle Ages was decimated, either killed or taken into sexual slavery, some of the crusaders from the north to the U.S. South were in fact killed. And I don't know how much good they did. In any event, they did not take any courses in sociology and anthropology, which I thought might have helped. I was just taking a little bit of an offbeat view, which was not being expressed by anybody else in the stable of KPFA commentators. So it went. And we continued to put out the Farm Labor magazine every month, almost every month, not quite every month, until in September of that year, all hell broke loose on the UC Berkeley campus. I think it began about the 20th September, something like that. And it became known as the free speech movement. Having to do with the fact that various political groups within the campus set up tables in which they recruited, tried to recruit members and sell copies of their publications or give it away. And the chancellor of the Berkeley campus, an elderly professor of psychology named Edward Strong, before he became chancellor, said it was contrary to campus rules and regulations and forbade it, and they refused to obey. And a lot were arrested, and the struggle went on for weeks. And it reminded me that I had once been involved in a free speech movement of my own, after a manner of speaking, involving a paper that I had written about the Bracero system, which I thought had really nothing to do with the campus. I didn't identify myself as a member of the campus community. I didn't distribute copies on the campus. I limited it to a small group of Quakers, I thought. But it leaked out, and as I understood the sequence of events, the Quakers distributed copies to the proponents of the Bracero system, thinking to educate them, I suppose. I don't know what they had in mind. But the Farm Bureau took great umbrage and complained to the head of the Agriculture Division of the university, and somebody in the chain of command devised a way to shut me up, which was to order an end to the field study I was conducting of the ideas and practices of braceros regarding healthcare. And I was obliged to stop the field work entirely and to dismiss my interviewer and limit myself to writing up a report on what I had already gathered, which was about half of the number of interviews that I thought were necessary to draw any conclusions. And eventually produced a 750-page monograph, which was rejected by my superior because the rationale given was I included a chapter on what I called the social structure of the bracero system, which included a mention of the groups that were in favor of it and the groups that were opposed to it, and that was all. But in fact, I was told on the QT that the real reason was that Farm Bureau had told the head of the agricultural division that when they came before the legislature the following session to ask for a budget to keep the university going, that they were going to ask embarrassing questions about having some firebrand working against their best interests, and that they would cut the university allotment for agricultural purposes. Well, that was all back in 1958. But I thought it was of some interest to the whole question of academic freedom and free speech on campus. And so I thought it was perfectly appropriate subject for me to do a commentary. And I conceived the idea that it was also the opportunity for me to bring out of mothballs the stencils of my 750-page monograph, which had in its original edition been recalled and destroyed, that I would use the mimeograph machine that we had purchased for the use of the Citizens for Farm Labor to put out our magazine. It was a pretty good quality mimeograph machine. And that I would run off copies, which I would sell to members of the Citizens for Farm Labor or other interested people, and that I would mention it in the conclusion of this KPFA commentary that I planned to do on the history of that whole episode. I wasn't able to get all of these ducks lined up in time for a commentary in the month of October, but I was able to do so on the November 13th commentary. Which I entitled, Who Will Guard Us from Our Guardians? And I announced that the original monograph could be obtained for $3.95 to cover our cost of paper and Mimeograph Inc. and in some cases postage. And I was able to get volunteers to assemble it. 750 pages, we made 100 copies, which comes to 75,000 pages. And according to my calculations, 150 reams of paper. And so we pretty much took over the house at 1624 Grove Street, as it was in those days. And my wife of the time was relegated to the back bedrooms with the two kids. Well, we spread out these hundreds and hundreds of copies. And people would assemble them in teams, in which maybe they were responsible for 20 pages, somebody else another 20, and eventually they were put together. Great big thick thing. And managed to sell almost all of them. I kept out maybe half a dozen to give to repositories like the Bancroft Library and the Library of Congress. But I wish I had kept more, because they're quite a collector's item today. Well, that was not by any means the end of the story. I don't know if it ever will be, but it seems that one of the listeners to my commentary took it upon herself to write a letter to Clark Kerr, who was the president of the whole university. And ask for his reaction to my commentary. Now, I must admit that I had made a bit of a leap, an assumption, that because he had told me at one time that he himself had read my statement to the friends about the immorality of the Bracero system, which I assumed meant that he was the Solomon who gave the even-handed decision on the one hand to resist the Farm Bureau's request that I be fired, but on the other hand to terminate my field work and to limit me to the writing of the report. Well, I now think, in retrospect, that it was not his idea, that it was the idea of somebody down the chain of command, and that they passed it in front of him, oh dear, with the right of review. He had the final say as to whether that Solomon-like decision would stand or whether he had some other way of dealing with it. So he let it stand. But in the commentary, I made it sound as though it was his decision. That was probably a mistake on my part. So anyway, Clark Kerr wrote a reply to this woman, which was quite interesting in its own way, because in the meanwhile, they had arrived at the rationale. And in his letter, he said that pressure from whatever source had nothing whatever to do with the university's decision, that it was solely the result of the fact that the U.S. Department of Labor, which operated the slave market in El Centro, through which all the braceros coming into California had to pass, had denied me and my interviewer the right of access to braceros at that location, and that made it impossible for me to continue the field study. Well, it's true that we had been denied access, which in itself probably could have been challenged if we had gone to the ACLU or anything like that, but we didn't feel it was necessary to interview at that location because there were any number of bracero camps in the Imperial Valley where it was possible to interview men on weekends and in the evenings. And even if we had been denied access by the operators of those camps, which had never happened, there were braceros on the streets of Calexico in the evenings and on weekends doing shopping for work clothes or whatever. And they were perfectly amenable to being interviewed. In fact, my interviewer did obtain a good deal of information in that way. So it was simply a fabrication that they came up with to justify the term, the the truncation of the project, let's put it that way. And I have to get a little bit of chronological order because I'm going to have to skip over something, but it's so directly related that I'll do so at this point. And that is that in April, now we're in the spring of 1965, and the ghost of Banquo still refuses to die and keeps popping up in unanticipated and unwanted settings. I got a call, I can't remember now whether it was written or by means of a telephone call, probably a telephone call, because I haven't been able to find a copy in writing of anything. I was invited to appear before the UC Senate Academic Freedom Committee. I believe that is the proper name for it. And I was given a time and place and a number to call in case I accepted the invitation. Well, I did accept the invitation by calling back because I was curious to see exactly what they wanted from me. I guess I thought that there was a possibility that maybe they weren't entirely satisfied with the official university explanation that it was all the fault of the U.S. Department of Labor and that pressure from any source, including the California Farm Bureau Federation, had absolutely nothing to do with the decision to truncate my university research. So I showed up at this committee of about half a dozen professors in the so-called Academic Freedom Committee. Well, it seems they were not at all interested in my understanding of God damn it, I meant to tell Virginia to take any such calls and to tell them I was not available.
Just let it ring.
We'll see.
Okay. We'll see. Yeah.
Okay. It turned out that what they were really interested in was getting a retraction from me as to retracting what I had said about Clark Kerr. They wanted to absolve Clark Kerr of any involvement whatever, and in fact, to absolve the university as a whole of any involvement that would cast any stain whatsoever upon the university's reputation as a citadel of academic freedom. Well, if If I had known it was going to be anything like this, I would have brought with me somebody else who knew something about the situation. It was more articulate than I, but under pressure, I've become very inarticulate. And I kind of stammered and hemmed and hawed. And said that surely there was more to it than the fact that the U.S. Department of Labor said we couldn't come to the Rosero Reception Center anymore. But they were not satisfied, and I wasn't satisfied, so it ended up with our going our respective ways and my becoming more jaundiced than I had been before. Oh, dear. In the meanwhile, back at Citizens for Farm Labor, we were doing quite well. There was a lengthy period here between about September of 64 and January of 65, in which we were able to put out the magazine every month because we were attracting a good many volunteers to help people who would write articles for us and people who would help with the scut work of typing stencils and keeping the books as to who was paying their annual fee of $5, and those who were subscribing to the magazine without actually becoming members of the organization and helping us recruit speakers at our monthly meetings and so forth and so on. And we were making our presence felt at public hearings legislative hearings and so forth. Kind of the golden age of CFL. I guess you could say because things were brewing down in the lower San Joaquin Valley. More specifically, in the little town of Delano. Cesar Chavez had been laying low, as I say, for a while, quite deliberately, operating under the radar, as they say nowadays. Organizing something he called the Agricultural Workers, wait a minute, the Farm Workers Association. not to be confused with the Agricultural Workers Association, AWA, as it was called, in Stockton before the emergence of AWOC, and that was the handiwork largely of Father Thomas McCullough. Dolores Huerta got involved. It was supplanted by AWOC after about 6 months, but it was quite a going concern. I myself almost became executive director of it. But Chavez, in the fall of 1962, began very quietly organizing what he called the Farm Workers Association, scrupulously avoiding any mention of the word union, because people got the idea that a union was something that existed for the purpose of going on strike. And Chavez had a totally different concept. It was to be something that conferred a lot of other benefits and did not require the direct confrontation with employers at all. It had a credit union, it had a health plan of sorts, it had various kinds of co-op ventures that people would help one another with odd jobs, carpentry or auto repair. They would work together in whatever they could within their competence, just for the practice of getting to know each other and trusting each other, and sacrificing a little bit because they had to pay dues to this association. And they began putting out a publication, which was very different in tone from our rather formal and serious and intellectual. The publication of the FWA was called El Macriado, which freely translated means the bad boy. And it was very outspoken in its opinion of growers, had a lot of humor in it, a lot of satire, cartoons, and we didn't have those things. And the volunteers that we attracted to help us with the activities of CFL frequently became very attracted by the activities going on down in Delano. And so we lost a fellow named Bill Esche, for example. He was very good as an associate editor. He moved down there and became the editor of El Malfriado. And we lost another one of our most faithful volunteers, a woman named Kathy Lynch, who went down there to help with their secretarial duties or whatever. Fell in love with a farm worker and married him. And so it went. We became a sort of a conduit. And We were happy to have it happen that way. We existed as a stopgap measure during the period of time when there was nobody speaking directly on behalf of farm workers themselves. The beauty of the FWA was that it was headed by people, all of whom had been farm workers themselves. Even in the AWA in Stockton, our guiding spirit was not a farm worker, had never been a farm worker. So, all of this is a lead up to the big events that took place in the fall of 1965. And this is a very logical point at which to end today and to leave you in suspense until next time, when things get really exciting.
Okay.
Ooh.